Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers. Additional KCRW programs and podcasts are available at kcrw.com.
My Porch Deal, Politics and National Security. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Democrats have dreamed about a chance to outflank President Bush on national security. Now his own administration may have handed opponents an issue. Republican leaders in Congress, right-wing talk radio, and neoconservatives are apoplectic over an Arab country controlling terminals at six American ports. On To the Point, how serious is the threat to national security in this age of globalization? Is the opposition bashing an Arab country that wants to be friends? Do those details and nuances even matter in an election year? On Reporter's Notebook later on, a new challenge to Roe versus Wade. First, here's the news. Hello again, Marvin Olney, back with To the Point. Republican leaders are among those bashing President Bush for letting an Arab country take over operations at six American ports. On To the Point, the president says there's no threat to security and suggests his opponents are bigots. Will the political beneficiaries of the flap be the Democrats? On Reporter's Notebook, we'll look at South Dakota's new anti-abortion law. Will it lead to overturning Roe versus Wade by the new U.S. Supreme Court? First, this news update, 95 to 100 people, most of them Sunnis, have been killed in 2 days of protests in the aftermath of yesterday's bombing of the Shiite Golden Mosque in Samarra. Now the most powerful Sunni party, the Iraqi Consensus Front, has quit the talks aimed at forming a unity government with Shiites and Kurds. Edward Wong is in Baghdad for the New York Times. Edward, let's first talk about those killed. I gather as many of them were prominent Sunni clerics.
There's a handful who were Sunni clerics. I wouldn't say many, but there were some Sunni clerics who were killed. That obviously raises a lot of concerns among both Sunnis and Shiites, and it's one of the reasons why political leaders have come out to try and call for restraint on the parts of civilians. Basically, they're saying that they don't want the country to descend into full-fledged civil war. Today, a lot of the violence had tapered off, but there still were some attacks, and we know that at least a couple mosques in Baghdad were burned today.
So again, this is a very sectarian matter with this very important Shiite mosque destroyed yesterday, and now with even a handful of Sunni clerics killed, I assume that really puts a sectarian look to it.
That's right. There's no doubt that this violence is sectarian in nature. I don't think anyone is doubting that at all or denying it. And basically, the Americans are trying hard to get the political groups to keep an open dialogue with each other, to keep talking. One of the main Sunni blocs did withdraw from talks to form a government, and they said that they would not come back to the table until those responsible for the anti-Sunni violence in the last 2 days have been brought to justice.
Again, we're talking with Edward Muang, who's New York Times reporter in Baghdad. What about the position of the Americans at the moment? They, of course, have been trying to get a unity government. Now we have a major Sunni party leaving the talks. Is the U.S. still, as we heard yesterday, being blamed to some extent for all of this?
They are. We're hearing blame from both sides, from the Sunnis and the Shiites. The Sunnis say that the Americans are asking why the Americans didn't step in to stop a lot of the violence that happened. The Shiites are saying that the shrine was, the Americans might be bearing some responsibility for the attack on the shrine because they've been telling the Shiites to pull back on basically using hardline methods in their government-run police and army forces. The Americans have basically, both groups are distancing themselves from the Americans, and the Americans are still trying to play the middleman at this point.
So the Americans are sort of damned if they do and damned if they don't. If they do intervene, they're accused of being too involved. If they don't, as we've heard today, they are blamed as well. What's the visibility now of American troops in Baghdad?
You do see them around, but they're playing a lower-level presence. You see a lot more Iraqi police officers manning checkpoints in the streets today than you do American troops. But in a lot of the more high-profile areas, like the Green Zone, for example, those are still surrounded by American troops, by American armor. And in the skies above Baghdad, we're hearing a lot of helicopters today, as we did yesterday, too.
You mentioned that political leaders are calling for restraint. Which leaders now appear to be in a position, if this is the right term, to take advantage of this situation, to come out ahead in a way, or is it a little early to tell?
Well, it's hard to say, but I think that there's speculation that the Shiite leaders might come out ahead because they were the ones who were being chastised by the Americans for turning a blind eye or even possibly supporting these government death squads, the ones in the Ministry of the Interior. And now they can step forward and say, look, the Americans were telling us to hold back, telling us to soften our stand, and now look what happened. The shrine was attacked. It's destroyed now, and we need to make sure we have the forces to protect our territory.
You mentioned the possibility of civil war. Are Arab politicians or Iraqi politicians, rather, themselves talking about that prospect, about full-fledged civil war?
They are. They're openly talking about that prospect right now, and I think they're trying to be candid with the people, saying that this is a very real possibility, and that if you don't step back from the edge, then you'll be pushing the country into this very dark maelstrom. I think that in order to try and impress on the population the gravity of the situation, they've been forced to mention civil war and to mention the possibility that families could be killing other families, neighbors killing neighbors.
Well, thank you very much for being with us, Edward Wong, again reporting in Baghdad for The New York Times. In a moment, the Dubai ports deal, politics and national security. To the point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Alney back with To the Point. At his cabinet meeting this morning, President Bush once again defended allowing an Arab company to control terminals at ports in New York, New Jersey, Baltimore, New Orleans, Miami, and Philadelphia. He called Dubai, part of the United Arab Emirates, a valuable partner in the war on terror, and he said that people don't need to worry about security. Frank Gaffney is one conservative Republican who is worried about security. He was high up in the Reagan Pentagon. He's now president and founder of the Center for Security Policy and a columnist for the Washington Times. And he's co-author of a new book called War Footing, 10 Steps America Must Take to Prevail in the War for the Free World. Mr. Gaffney, as always, welcome to our program.
Well, it's wonderful to be with you, Warren. Thank you for having me.
How concerned are you about this takeover of some terminals at those American ports by a company owned in Dubai?
I think we have to be concerned about it. I personally am quite concerned. The reason for that is that this is a country from which most of the operational planning and financing of the 9/11 attacks took place. That creates the reasonable presumption that the company in question, the government that owns it, at least the territory from which they operate, may once again become a base of terrorist plotting against us. And this arrangement, whereby the Dubai Ports World Company has access to personnel, has access to cargo, has access to the security plans, simply compounds what is already a very difficult security problem at our ports, and I think unnecessarily so.
Do they really have hands-on access to those things? It's my understanding that what they do is unload what has been put on ships someplace else.
I believe that it's to be expected that decisions about who does the offloading, or at least who supervises the offloading, decisions about perhaps, or at least knowledge of the cargo moving through those ports to be offloaded, and certainly some degree of familiarity with the security plan for the port, because the company is going to be responsible for at least part of it. all creates what I think lawyers would call an attractive nuisance, like a swimming pool without a fence around it. Somebody's going to get in it and make problems, I think. And that's what worries me, is the kinds of problems that could be created in our ports, which are virtually without exception located near major population centers. They have sensitive and, in many cases, strategically important facilities, all of which could be affected perhaps in a quite profound way by an attack were one to be mounted in an inside job.
Frank Gaffney again with the Center for Security Policy in Washington. Harlan Ullman is national security expert at the Center for Security and International Studies. Mr. Ullman, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
What do you say, first, to the question of Dubai's involvement, or at least in the United Arab Emirates, there was planning for September 11th. There was also allegedly, according to a Democratic Senator, Carl Levin, today at a Senate committee hearing on this subject, involvement in moving money that was used by al-Qaeda.
Well, first, Frank Caffney and I often differ on many policy issues. It's rather interesting that in this particular case, he's opposed to the administration, and I, for a rare time, am partly in agreement with the administration. There are three points. First, regarding the security and the ownership of, I shouldn't say the ownership, the management of the six ports. The fact of the matter is that it's going to have no effect on the security of those particular ports. Indeed, it might even be slightly helpful to the security, simply because there's going to be far greater scrutiny on the part of the United States, and I think far greater concern by DP Global for managing it. The Coast Guard, and of course...
Excuse me, DP Global is the Dubai company, that is buying...
Buying P&O ship navigation.
Which is London-based.
London-based.
Go ahead.
And so I think that at very least it'll get the United States, I think, a little bit more closely involved with that particular international network. So I think that at worst it's a wash, but it's going to have no effect on the security. Second, the politics. You're seeing a lot of proxy politics here. A lot of people in the Congress who are very unhappy with the administration over national security are using this as an issue to beat the administration over the head. You'll remember that the issue over torture, the issue over so-called domestic spying or foreign or surveillance of potential terrorists, a whole range of things. Iraq have made a lot of Republicans and Democrats very uncomfortable, and so this is a great issue to take on. And quite frankly, most Americans are a little bit worried. They reflect the concerns that Frank Gaffney has raised. The White House has been very, very heavy-handed. They did not deal with this in a sensible way. I mean, anybody who's been in politics would know that if you're considering offloading the ownership and management of American ports to a foreign company, particularly an Arab one, at least you have to brief Congress and make this not a surprise. And so those are two very important issues. The larger issue, of course, is the security of our ports, irrespective of who does the management. And quite frankly, this is a disaster waiting to happen. I co-chaired a study on the security of the ports of New York and New Jersey 2 years ago. And what we saw then was exactly what the House report on the handling of Katrina gave in terms of the criticisms of our response. There is really no coordination among all levels. The amount of information that was exchanged was really not satisfactory. And indeed, there still is not any kind of an electronic or fiber backbone in the ports or anywhere else that relates the local people with the city people, with the state people, with the federal people. And so there is no doubt that our ports have some degree of vulnerability. And quite frankly, in the time since September 11th and all the billions of dollars we have spent, it has not been spent very wisely. And this is an area where the administration and Congress have to focus, irrespective of whether this sale goes through or not.
Again, Harlan Ullman with the Center for Security and International Studies. Frank Gaffney, I suspect you agree that the port security issue in general is a disaster waiting to happen. Mr. Ullman says that the acquisition by the Dubai-based company of the company that manages some terminals would actually increase our ability to maintain security.
Well, we certainly do agree that port security is already problematic. And indeed, that I think makes my point. Would you do anything that might make it harder? Look, he may be right that we're going to be a lot smarter about efforts that could be made from the United Arab Emirates, which is, as it has been in the past, awash with an ideology I call Islamofascism, and people who adhere to it who wish to do us harm. We may be able better to monitor their activities, their attempts to penetrate this concern, thereby gaining access to our ports, thereby having a new opportunity to attack us in a way that could conceivably be much more devastating, certainly economically and maybe in terms of loss of life, than even what we saw they were able to do to us in 9/11. I'm simply saying I don't know that that's the case, and I do think that there's going to be that underlying activity going on, whether we can monitor it better or not, and that will make an already difficult and already very worrying problem of port security in this country considerably worse. And I guess on this point, Harlan and I would certainly agree. I hope the silver lining out of this, irrespective of the outcome of this deal, and personally I'm quite confident it is going to be rejected in one fashion or another, but I think irrespective of it, I'm hoping the benefit to the country is that there will be the kind of concerted public attention and congressional attention on port security or insecurity that we really haven't given this problem since 9/11.
I want to get on to those other issues, but you say that you think this definitely will be rejected. President Bush has said that he would veto any bill that came out of the Congress. The leaders of both parties seem to be very interested in such a deal, particularly the Republicans, who, of course, control the Congress. Do you think it'll come to that? And if so, what about an override of the veto?
Well, as I say, I don't know what way this is going to be played out ultimately. It may be as with the situation we discussed a while back, Warren, the Chinese taking their dishes and dolls and going home on the purchase of Unocal when it became apparent that it was going to cost them a lot in terms of public scrutiny of their activities. That may be what happens here. It may be that the company goes ahead with the deal, but sloughs off the ports. And by the way, I think there's considerably more than six ports involved here. I'm in Texas today. I heard on National Public Radio's local affiliates that a number of ports that I wasn't aware of, including Houston and Port Arthur, in addition to Beaumont and Corpus Christi, are also having some services provided by P&O today and presumably would be by the UAE in the future. These are the sorts of things that make me feel, when you look at the political lay of the land, it may come to the president trying to veto something, but I think it will be in the face of a veto-proof margin. I just don't see the support for his position in the Congress, and that probably will mean he doesn't veto this bill, just as he hasn't vetoed any other bill in the past 5 years. I doubt this is going to be the first one he wants to cast.
Harlan Ullman, back to you. What about Houston, Port Arthur, Beaumont, Corpus Christi? A lot of military shipping presumably goes through those ports. Does that concern you?
No, this is really a problem, in my judgment, that we really needn't worry about. If the bad guys want to infiltrate, they would do it irrespective of who was managing the ports. And what we have to realize is the real danger starts from where the ports of embarkation are overseas. And one of the advantages of teaming up with the DP is, of course, that they manage a huge amount of the overseas stuff. So I think that this provides some opportunity. Also, you probably may or may not know that the government of Singapore, the government of China, also own, or I should say have the management rights, the ports of Los Angeles. So if we're going to preclude foreign ownership, we're going to have to start drawing the lines someplace. I think, look, this is the issue. If it gets to a real fight between the president and the Congress, my guess is the president is not going to exercise a veto. He's the first president since James Garfield who has not exercised a veto. But my guess is, just like it happened with the terrorist surveillance issue and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, when Congress was given the information, it sort of changed its mind. And one of my problems with Congress is that Congress really has not exerted much of a backbone in providing oversight for the administration. It hasn't done with Homeland Security. It hasn't done with protection of the ports. I think there'll be some Democrats and a few Republicans. When you take a look, and I don't mean to diminish Frank's concerns, I just don't think at this particular case they're going to be here. You can make the argument that no matter which foreign ownership applied, they could have similar problems. I think that we have ways around it, and I think this is really a very small issue. Let me just finish for a second.
Okay.
When you step back and take a look, however, of the United States, we are unbelievably dependent and vulnerable on lots of things. For example, most of our software is written in India. one day most of our chips for computers are going to come from China. What we need to do is to take a sensible look at our infrastructure and determine where we're vulnerable, where we are dependent, and what we do about it. The ports and the vulnerability of the ports, in my judgment, is a separate issue from who owns the management rights. And we have to look at this very seriously. And for some reason, government, that's the White House and Congress, have not held anybody accountable. The discrepancies that have been there in terms of failure to have communications, to be able to exchange information. I mean, who, for example, is in charge? Now, New York is a much more complicated situation because you've got four states there. It's easier in places like California, Texas, and Florida. But if we have a crisis, as we saw in Katrina, who is in charge? And the government has really not done any kind of a good job in stating that. So before the fact, we've been able to train and prepare, and we know what's going to happen. That, to me, is really the larger issue that has to be addressed. And quite frankly, focusing on Dubai just dilutes the issue of our larger vulnerability and our dependencies, unfortunately.
Very quickly, before I get Frank Gaffney to address that issue, he says that he thinks Islamo-fascist recruiters and adherents are present in Dubai and in the United Arab Emirates in large numbers. Do you deny that?
Not at all. I mean, I have a different name. I call this jihadist extremists. But in any event, they're also present in the United States. Three American citizens naturalized were arrested the other day, and three Americans were arrested in September in Folsom Penitentiary who were plotting terrorist attacks against the United States. So obviously there are going to be more of the bad guys overseas, but let's not deny they exist in Britain, as we found out last July with the attacks against the underground. They exist here in the United States, even though in smaller numbers. So this is a problem that exists throughout much of the world and something we have to recognize.
Okay. Back to Frank Gaffney. What about the contention that this really is a diversion, that we have much more important things we ought to be worried about, much more imminent threats?
I don't think it's a diversion. I think it is a symptom of a larger problem, and I think many of the things Harlan has just said I agree with. We certainly have a problem with Islamofascists, I would insist they be called, because I think it's a political ideology. Not a religion, though it masquerades as one, that is giving rise domestically as well as internationally to the most immediate threat we face. We've got a new book on this called War Footing, which talks about how to contend with it. But I think that he's right to be sure that we have foreign dependencies. I mean, this is the underbelly of globalization. Even our military is, to an extraordinary degree, dependent upon foreign suppliers for critical parts and material, and it gives rise to vulnerabilities. Is this the only vulnerability, our ports? Absolutely not. Is this the only thing we should worry about in terms of our ports vulnerability? Absolutely not. Is it something that both is instructive about a larger set of problems and is one that the public gets? And it's for that reason that I think that you're going to see Congress overriding a presidential veto, if there were one. It's the old Groucho Marx line, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? The public understands that this just doesn't make sense. Does it also make sense to have Communist China running some of our port facilities? It's a very interesting, important question. Part of what I hope this larger public policy debate triggered by this issue will produce.
We need to take a break, and we'll be right back. Frank Gaffney with the Center for Security Policy, Harlan Ullman with the Center for Security and International Studies, both in Washington. We'll have other guests as well. On Reporter's Notebook, will a new challenge to Roe versus Wade go from South Dakota to the U.S. Supreme Court? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point, talking today about DP Global, a company owned by the state the government of Dubai, part of the United Arab Emirates. The takeover of operations at terminals in several American ports, six or more, depending on who you talk to. Is that or is that not a threat to security in the United States? President Bush says no. A lot of people, as both of our guests so far have conceded, I think that it really at least looks like a security problem, whether it really is one or not. Dick Pohlman, who's chief national political writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, also has a blog at dickpohlman.blogspot.com, calls this another Harriet Myers moment for President Bush. Dick, thanks a lot for joining us.
A pleasure to be here, Warren.
What do you mean by a Harriet Myers Meyer's moment.
Well, I think actually a number of people, including, I believe, maybe one of your guests, has used that.
Frank Gaffney has also used that in the Washington Times.
And
I don't know who originated it.
I don't know who, but a bunch of us thought it all around the same time because it just seemed like the parallels were so obvious, at least in terms of the political implications and the way that the administration seems to have sort of made decisions without consulting even its friends.
Harriet Myers, of course, the White House lawyer who was appointed briefly to be the next justice of the Supreme Court, her appointment then being withdrawn after a lot of opposition from, as you point out, friends of the White House.
I think what's happening here more than the serious problem here, I think, potentially is that this seems to be another example of the White House's inability really to communicate in advance really to its own allies what it's doing. People get taken by surprise and in some ways they make things worse for themselves at the White House by operating this way, because then people, you know, are reacting, after the fact. Congress is upset. Maybe they'd be upset on the merits of this thing anyway. But I think the longstanding pattern of not consulting with Congress has probably got people's, trigger fingers a lot more itchy.
What happened to Karl Rove?
Well, you know, it's curious about that. I mean, I've talked to people about this today, and one of the arguments I've heard is that, and this may or may not, I don't know how valid this is, but one of the arguments is that Karl Rove is even though he does care about the future of trying to build a ongoing congressional GOP majority, his first his first allegiance is to the president and the president's agenda, and that doesn't necessarily, I mean, this White House is beyond Rove, this White House has a long track record of not consulting with its allies in Congress. They're the ones on the ballot this year. The president is not anymore on the ballot.
Well, what about the possibility that this deal might in some way be either rescinded by the president, or that he might invoke what Carl Levin today, a Democrat in the Senate, says is a part of American law, that if there's a security issue, you have to have another 45 days of study. Is that an out, a political out for the White House?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're all probably going to see, which is a common pattern in politics, certainly wouldn't be the Bush administration inventing it, is some kind of face-saving device whereby they can sort of back down despite the president's defiance the last couple of days. Some kind of face-saving device so that everybody can sort of, that the Republicans can all kind of, get on the same page. And that would probably mean more time, more study, time for the voices to be lowered. Something maybe the equivalent of, it would be the equivalent of, Harriet Mears pulled out supposedly on her own because of the issue of not allowing Congress to see private White House documents. So they found some technical grounds where they could basically withdraw from.
In the meantime, we have, again, Carl Levin, Hillary Rodham Clinton also today in the Senate taking advantage of the hearing to bash the administration on this. Is this an opportunity for the Democrats to look as if, at least for the moment, as if they're tougher on national security than the Republicans are?
Well, the thing all along here, I think what's been most upsetting to some of the Republicans who have to run for re-election this year is that, they've basically been expecting, and Rove signaled last month that one of the big themes again this year was going to be that you can trust the Republicans more to keep Americans safe. So this is basically would be a pillar theme this year, and the idea that allow the Democrats to have an opening where they can run to the president's right on national security / homeland security. That's something that, the Democrats have been anxious for a while, I think, to point out that spending on homeland security and ports in particular has not necessarily been, as good as it could be. This gives them an opportunity to do so. And they're in the middle of trying to, rehab their or upgrade their image, and close that 30-year deficit that the Democrats have had on national security. Perception of strength.
We had plenty of agreement from our first two guests, Frank Gaffney and Harlan Ullman, about the situation at the ports and with the lack of security there, even though they disagreed about whether or not the acquisition of companies by DP Global was going to make a big difference in that. Again, Dick Pullman, chief national political writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. The president himself has suggested that there may be an element of bigotry in all of this, that Arab countries are being treated by a different standard than other countries, the point already having been made on this call or this program, that China and Singapore and a lot of other foreign countries already operate terminals in American ports. James Zogby is president of the Arab American Institute. He's currently traveling in the Middle East. And James Zogby, always good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much, Warren.
How is this being seen by Arab Americans in the first place and by, in the second place, Arabs overseas?
Well, I think that the level of rhetoric that's been used has been shameful, it's been irresponsible, and it's been very ill-informed. Anyone who knows Abu Dhabi knows Dubai and knows the Emirates generally knows that they've been an incredibly strong ally of the United States. They've actually gone out on a limb, stuck their neck out in a number of ways. First country to sign the Container Security Initiative. That means every single container going from the ports in Dubai to the United States are checked by U.S. customs officials on the ground in the country. They have customs officials, FBI, working with them on the ground every day, and it's something that they've done on their own initiative. They know that they have troops fighting with the U.S. in Afghanistan, and they know that they've supported the U.S. military by providing the single largest port base for U.S. military ships in the Gulf. So the question people are saying is, if the UAE gets this kind of rhetoric, Frank Lautenberg calling it a rogue government.
Senator from New Jersey.
The senator from Pennsylvania, calling it an Islamic fascist state, et cetera. If that's the kind of rhetoric you use about a friend, then what do those terms mean? And can any Arab government get a fair shake in the United States? And the answer is most probably not. And yes, there is bigotry, and Arab Americans are feeling it because they reel in reaction to the kind of language used to describe this country. But here in the Middle East, there's a tremendous sense of hurt, of anger, of frustration, and of just absolute puzzlement over these characters in Congress sort of tripping over themselves to get to a microphone, hyperventilating over their own rhetoric.
Well, what about the argument that there was a lot of planning for 9/11 going on in the United Arab Emirates, and that apparently some of the people involved in that actually launched themselves from there, that the UAE was one of the handful of countries in the world to recognize the Taliban regime in Afghanistan? I'm reading here from remarks made today by Democratic Senator Carl Levin, and that millions of dollars in al-Qaeda funds went through UAE financial institutions. Doesn't that give them some basis for argument?
The actual training took place in Germany, but we consider Germany an ally because it's white people like us. The fact is that there was a person born in UAE who was one of the 19 terrorists, but so too are folks born in Britain terrorists, and there are folks who were born in Germany and who were recruited by al-Qaeda who became terrorists. Place of origin and where you run your money through. Look, I know, and 9/11 Commission knows, I heard from President Clinton after he left the White House, that in a post-9/11 piece of research, the 19 terrorists had dozens of American credit cards that they'd maxed out on. So I guess you could say that U.S. financial institutions also funded the terrorist act of 9/11. The fact is that financial institutions don't do a security check before you get a bank account there. And that is a simple issue that we need to deal with. The 9/11 Commission didn't find any foreign money responsible for the attacks. And those who are saying that it was are simply, it's a canard. And they're using it, and they think that they can get away with it because it's an Arab country. It's the last ethnic group that you can say anything about and not be held accountable for. And I mean it. It's like I watched the press conference when those guys, the first six, came out with their letter to Secretary Rice. And it was like the kids' game telephone, you know. Each one, kind of, you could see what was going on in their heads. How am I going to get the soundbite tonight? How can I be a little more outrageous than the guy who came before? How can I up the rhetoric? And they could say whatever they wanted to say, a base of terrorism, a home of terrorism, a rogue government, knowing that because it's an Arab government, no one in America was going to make them pay a political price. Couldn't say that about another country. You can only say it about Arabs. And that's what bothers me here. What should have happened is, I agree, the administration should have been more out front early on in snuffing this out and dealing with the reality of how our security does take place at the ports. Coast Guard stays the same. The customs people stay the same. The ability we have to provide security at our ports will not be impacted by where the monthly check goes at the end of each period. The only issue at stake here is who's name is on the paper that owns it. Nothing else changes. White House should have done that early on. Secondly, I think that members of Congress, if they were responsible and not posturing for political purposes, should have asked some questions, not engaged in race baiting against Arabs and saying the kinds of things they said. I listened to Peter King. I listened to Frank Lautenberg. I read what Santorum said, and frankly, it was way over the top and wrong. And it's dangerous in the region. Karen Hughes was just here doing public diplomacy. You know, she ought to pack her bags and go back to Texas, because if this deal falls through, you cannot do public diplomacy in this region, because people don't judge you by what you say about yourself. They judge you by how you treat them. And this is shabby treatment for a country that's been an ally.
James Dugby, once again, president of the Arab American Institute, traveling at the moment in the Middle East. Let me go back to Dick Pullman with the Philadelphia Inquirer, chief national political writer. What about that statement that Arabs now are the last ethnic group about which you can say anything in America and not have to pay a political price? You think that's true?
Well, to some extent, I suppose. I would say, however, that I think there's something that he said is that Mr. Zoghbi said is spot on, which is that a lot of this could have been avoided if the White House had sort of seeded the ground a little bit. You know, there's no reason to think that all these people, with the Republicans on the Hill being so nervous about re-election, that if the White House had any political sensitivity to what they're facing, that you know, they couldn't have made some of the arguments that Mr. Zoghbi was making in advance, and perhaps that might have, if they brought them in and made these arguments up front proactively, maybe it would have given some of these people pause before they, as he put it, you know, race to the microphone, because it's been a bipartisan racing to the microphone.
Okay, Dick Pullman with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Back to Frank Gaffney, again with the Center for Security Policy, another who has called this a Harriet Myers or Mears moment for the White House. James Dugby says he thinks that the rhetoric has been shameful. It's been ill-informed. You heard all the things that he did say, called it race baiting by some of the politicians, including Peter King, the Republican congressman from New York. What do you say to that? Has that been an element of all of this, aside from the arguments over the merits?
Well, I haven't heard all the rhetoric, I'm sure, and I wouldn't defend everybody who's spoken on this issue. But I will say, I mean, Jim's reflexive position is the Arabs are the victims here, and everybody who says anything about them is blameful for race baiting or what have you. I think the reality is that, as I said in carefully chosen words, most of the operational planning and the financial arrangements for 9/11 were undertaken.
Okay, excuse me. I don't want to make you rehash all of that.
The second point is this is a broken process. I mean, everybody's criticizing the administration for not having, you know, briefed the Congress. It's a black box that's run by this organization called the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. You can't pre-brief. It's one of the things I hope also will come out of this public policy debate is how do we fix this evaluation of questionable foreign investments in the United States where they are likely, as I think is the case in this deal,
okay,
to impinge upon national security.
What about the impact on America's image in the Middle East amongst Arabs and Muslims around the world that James Dugby is talking about? Is that a problem?
Well, it's one of the reasons why I would have preferred to see this deal shut down or changed early on, because I happen to believe the UAE is a valuable ally at the moment. It hasn't always been, but it is at the moment, and we ought to be trying to maintain that relationship as best we can. As between creating new problems for us in terms of our security at home and creating new problems for image abroad, I think you've got to weigh more heavily homeland security. But I do think the right answer here, as was described by one of your other guests, I think, is to find an arrangement that saves face for everybody, okay. And I think that's what will happen.
Back to Harlan Ullman at the Center for Security and International Studies.
Center for Strategic International Studies, Warren.
I beg your pardon.
They would not like it. That's all right.
That's written wrong in the note I got, and I will correct it. but thank you for correcting me. What do you say to the issues raised by James Dugby about the image impact of all of this?
Well, I actually haven't been part of the CFIUS, the Committee for Foreign Investment. There are some things that have to be changed, but actually it works quite well, and they are pretty free to do whatever they want. I've been involved and in part of that. So, yes, there might be some changes, but I think that's probably less of an issue.
Could there have been briefing in advance, or is
absolutely.
It very,
there ways
not very
that.
Secret?
Absolutely. There okay. are ways that could have been done without breaching confidentiality, and there's no doubt that the administration made a huge mess of it, right. as it's done with other things.
Back to the question the larger issue,
think of what's happening right now in the greater Middle East. The United States has been hit by these horrible photographs from Abu Ghraib just again. We've had these cartoons that have led to protests. We just had the Golden Mosque blown up in Iraq. All these things do not do us any good. And to overlay this, and I think Jim Zogby's view of what the reaction in the Middle East is going to be, I haven't seen a headline from the Middle East yet, but it certainly will be the question, would we have done this if it was an Israeli company? The United States is absolutely losing the strategic communication war of ideas, and this is further ammunition. The administration and the Congress has to understand that we need a message that talks about our strengths and our virtues, and we are not able to do that, and incidents like this right now are going to be very, very harmful and are going to contribute to how the United States is being held in growing disrespect, no matter what we say or what we do, and it's going to be used against us. We have to step back and realize we are in a tough fight. We are dealing with really nasty, capable people who can do bad things. I agree with Frank. This is a long-term struggle, yet we have not been able to put in place the means to wage a diplomatic or preventive diplomacy program to deal with these guys in terms of the war of ideas. And unfortunately, no matter how this works with Dubai, even if it's approved, but especially if it's not, this is going to redound against us. Okay. We're talking about civil war in Iraq right now. Why? In large part because people are able to use all this sort of information against us, and this is just going to redound further.
Let me go back to Dick Pullman with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Are the Democrats, by jumping on this bandwagon, losing another issue, which is the one just expressed by Dick Pullman, that the Republicans have created a situation where the United States is in deep trouble in the Middle East?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Yeah, sure.
You threw me off, Warren, because I think you referred that I had said the Republican thing. I think that was your previous guess.
No. That's what I said. It seems to me that this is the question I wanted to put to you, that the Democrats, by jumping on this issue, are losing another issue, which
yes.
is that they have the opportunity to criticize the Republicans for creating a situation. They could blame the Republicans. They may not be responsible, but certainly politically they could blame them, and it seems to me they are for what's happened to America's image, particularly in the Middle East, but in other parts of the world as well. By getting one advantage, do they lose another?
Yes, entirely possible, because one advantage is only short-term. It's the long-term thing that really matters in the end. Certainly to voters who are maybe looking in the larger picture as to whether the Democratic Party is, whether they can view the Democratic Party as responsible enough, you know, to turn over the reins in 2008, because it's a question of, you know, what is, you know, America's standing in the world and how best do we improve it. And so, yeah, I mean, so there's a certain amount of just short-term opportunism going on right now. And I think actually I read some of the more, let's just say, the more responsible, clear-headed, level-headed blogs that are on the left side of the political spectrum. And a number of them actually today have been, and yesterday have been talking about this, saying, look, let's not lapse into, you know, xenophobic jingoism here. We have to keep the big picture.
Dick Pullman with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Final question for James Zogby, president of the Arab American Institute. Will there be long-term damage to the United States overseas, regardless of how this issue is ultimately resolved here?
No, look, they've heard the rhetoric. They've also seen the president stand up and defend the deal. We've got enough problems in the region that are dividing us from the people in this area. Iraq is one, the Israel-Palestine issue is another, and our behavior towards Arabs and Muslims, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, et cetera, are still others. This issue, if it goes through, can be neutralized. If we back out, or if we find what for the administration works as face-saving at home, then I think there will be damage. Damage, in particular, among the private sector. I just completed a study, a survey of Gulf business leaders, how they view the present and how they look to the future. Frankly, right now, people are saying you know, we can wait 5-10 years and do business with China and India. They want our oil. They want to do business with us. And frankly, we don't have to deal with the bigotry we deal with when we try to get to the United States. I think that the damage is a public diplomacy issue, yes, but there's also a long-term economic consequence that we may pay if major investors say there's no point in doing business with America. The price is too high and the damage is too great.
We have to leave it at that for the moment. To James Zogby, president of the Arab American Institute, thanks for being with us. Thanks to Dick Pohlman with the Philadelphia Inquirer, Harlan Ullman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Frank Gaffney at the Center for Security Policy in Washington. We'll hear more about this one on future programs. With two new conservative justices now on the bench in Washington, the state of South Dakota is moving to challenge Roe versus Wade in the U.S. Supreme Court. The state Senate has passed the most far-reaching abortion ban in the union. Even before the governor signs it, Planned Parenthood is ready with an appeal. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Werman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. South Dakota's new law would make it a felony for doctors to perform abortions with no exceptions for rape, incest, or the health of the mother. Politicians in that state seem to think that that will get it to the U.S. Supreme Court. Not everybody, however, in the anti-abortion movement agrees with that, in part because they think the law is a lot more complicated than that. Keith Perrine is legal affairs reporter for the Congressional Quarterly in Washington. And Keith, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure.
What about the prospects of actually getting this to the U.S. Supreme Court, so extreme as it is, with no exceptions for rape, incest, or the health of the mother?
Well, because the law that South Dakota has passed is structured that way, I think it will eventually get to the court, although it could take a couple of 3 years for it to get through the lower courts and get up there.
Will the court necessarily accept it?
Not necessarily, but under the court's rules, it takes four justices to agree to hear a case, and so if four of them feel strong enough about one another, then the court will take it.
Aren't there cases subsequent to Roe versus Wade, though, that make the situation somewhat more complicated, and isn't there some sentiment, even on the court, for the idea of exceptions, especially for the health of the mother?
Well, The situation is more complicated than a lot of people realize, and there is sentiment on the court. In fact, the court's jurisprudence right now is that in order for abortion laws to be constitutional, they have to contain an exception for the health of the mother. I stress the court's jurisprudence right now because that could change as early as next year.
How's that?
Well, the court this week has just agreed to hear a challenge to a 2003 federal law that outlawed late-term abortion procedure that opponents of the procedure call partial birth abortion. That Congress passed that law in 2003 in response to a 2000 Supreme Court decision that voided a Nebraska state law, a Nebraska state ban on those abortions. The court voided the Nebraska law because it didn't have a health exception. Congress, in response to that, passed this federal law also without a health exception and included pages and pages of congressional findings that such late-term abortions were never medically necessary, so the law didn't need a health exception. That's going to be before the lower federal courts have ruled that unconstitutional in three federal circuits, and now that case is going to be in front of the new court and its two new justices in its next term.
Well, isn't there a medical opinion, though, that's pretty clear that sometimes abortions are necessary in order to protect the health and sometimes the life of the mother?
Well, there are medical opinions to that effect, but then there are also medical opinions to the effect, in terms of this late-term procedure, that it's never medically necessary. There's two different questions. If you're thinking of abortion generally, well, yes, there's certainly that argument out there, but the thing is, who abortion opponents are too worried that how do you write that health exception, because doctors could just say, well, it's necessary even if maybe it isn't to protect the health of the mother. And here I'm giving the argument of the abortion foes.
I understand. Keith Perrine, once again, legal affairs reporter for the Congressional Quarterly in Washington. Apparently Ohio, Indiana, Georgia, Tennessee, Kentucky are also thinking about similar measures. Would that increase the likelihood, do you think, that the U.S. Supreme Court might have to take a look at this?
Well, I think it would. If the more activity there is at the state level, the more legal challenges there will be. As you pointed out in your introduction, an abortion rights group is mounting a legal challenge to South Dakota's action, and that'll just continue. So there will be different cases in different federal courts and so on, and the court will likely step in one way or another in the future on that.
From a political standpoint, is this likely to produce a lot of fundraising on both sides of the issue?
Well, I think so. I think so, yes, because both sides will. I think the proponents in South Dakota, didn't they say they had $1 million ready already from contributors to fight the legal challenges to the law? And the other side certainly will. Abortion rights groups will certainly tell its supporters that abortion rights are at risk, and so they need to mount a fight, and then money will come in that way, too.
All right. So in case anybody thought that this wasn't going to be a very lively and active issue in the immediate political future, forget that. It's going to be a major one for a long time to come. Keith Perrine, thanks a lot for being with us.
Sure.
Legal Affairs Reporter, Congressional Quarterly in Washington, D.C. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Karen Radziner and Christian Bordahl, Technical Director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.